When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello and welcome to a very special Christmas broadcast of Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chiclet that made us who we are. My name is Karen O'Donoghue and I'm an author and an old subhuman. Joining me is cookbook writer and the owner of a small hen empire, Ella Risbridger.
Hi.
Hi.
It's the Christmas special.
Christmas special.
Thank you for joining me for the Christmas special.
I was going to say thank you for joining me in my house.
In your living room where, yes, I have brought the dog because I feel like we can't do a kitchen table broadcast without She has her nose on the laptop right now. So tell the lovely people out there in garbage land what we're doing today while I open this Prosecco.
What we're doing today is we're going to drink this Prosecco once Caroline has opened it, which I hope she does with a thematic pop. And we're going to talk to you about the Mitford sisters and the novels and various writings of, brackets most of, close brackets, the Mitford sisters.
Oh, hang on. I think it's coming. Oh, lovely.
God, rest ye merry gentlemen.
And not a drop of overspill. Did you clap that? Did you clap that? Did you see that?
Listeners, she opened it with panache.
So I was thinking for a while that I should do like a Christmas episode for this. And I kind of didn't know what to do because I couldn't really think of a lot of books that I truly... First of all, I knew I wanted to do it with you because you are like the unofficial kind of aunt of the pod.
That's true.
You know,
I am.
Maiden aunt of the pod.
And I'm already drunk.
And you're already pissed, which is good. Cheers, babe.
Cheers. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
And to you.
And
kind listeners.
You kind listeners. We've got lots of like piles of Mitford books in front of us. Some of them are like biographies, some of them are collected letters, novels, etc., memoirs, that kind of thing. And a lot of them were given to each other as Christmas presents, which is really sweet.
Yeah, counting. I think there's 11 books about the Mitfords in this room right now. Yeah. Oh no, 12. There's a little sneaky little Ons and Rebels.
Yeah,
Slim Penguin Classic.
And like literally, I'm just picking up the Mitford's Letters Between Six Sisters, which is a compilation of all the correspondence. And it says here, just December 14th, Ella, I desperately wanted to keep this. You jammy bitch, love you. It's just like, because we have been friends for so long and because every Christmas is punctuated by something Mitford adjacent, they've become very synonymous with Christmas for me, I think.
I think there's also something very Christmassy about that sense of the English country house, isn't there? I think,
yeah.
Without wanting to get too academic about it, I think a great deal of the way we talk about Christmas, particularly in this country. And I think the idea of an English country Christmas is very burnt into how people think about it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, the snow and the ice skating and the roaring fire and the family all gathered round, which is, I guess, in a sense, particularly what Nancy, but also Decca and a bit Debo are writing around and against, is that idea of the aristocratic.
It's so
English
true. And I was thinking that today because I always seem to find myself, as soon as it becomes like Advent, I am curled up, I'm rereading Love on a Cold Climate, Pursuit of Happiness, The Letter is Whatever. And it's because there's so much being cold, which is very Christmas, and there's so much having to spend too much time with your family.
That's exactly what I was just about to say.
Making up stupid games, but also resenting. There's so much hate and love and private jokes and games that goes on.
And games that no one else can understand. Like, you know, it's the bit in Ons and Rebels where they talk about playing, I think it's called Hair, Hear, Cure, Commencement, where you just have to cause each other pain and the first person to cry out is the loser. And another game which they call Slowly Wearing Away, where you take the hand of a grown-up who is doing like something else and you just slowly start rubbing your nail harder and harder along their skin until they notice and are angry.
I mean, like, I know all of the sisters write about how they weren't allowed to go to school and how dreadful that was, but it's hard to know whether it's chicken or the egg. It's like, should these children have been allowed out, or was because they were never allowed out the reason they were so fucking weird?
But then, I don't know, I think a lot about that bit in Pursuit of Love, where... I mean, are you going to do, like, a summary of the Mitfords?
I was actually going to ask you, because you introduced me to the Mitfords, and I want you to explain to people who don't know who they are exactly who they are.
The Mitfords they're all now dead. I was going to say rest in peace, but it felt oddly formal. They are my friends.
They are my friends.
I feel about them like family, in that I am deeply ashamed of some of them. Yeah. And I am very mad about a lot of their behaviour, and a lot of it I just think, well, Jesus, don't look at me. I didn't do it. I'm not a Nazi. Or the thing is, the Nazi feels like a low blow, but we'll get to my feelings on.
Yeah, we've thought very long and hard about Nazism and throughout the Mitfords, but go on, continue.
But just the generally terrible things I feel very bad about, but also their family. I've been reading these books for so long, and obviously I have a lot of sisters myself. I feel obviously a deep kinship with books about sisters, but it's more than that. It's this particular kind of quite chaotic.
Mm.
The Mitfords are six sisters, one brother. No one really knows or cares about the brother.
Mm. He's up there with Bramwell Bronte. Is just being
he's truly a Bramwell.
Yeah.
You know, they all liked him a lot, but he was always at school and then he was dead in a war, which is the function of men in the past.
And importantly, so they were the daughters of a peer. And what's his full name again?
Lord Redesdale. I was trying to think of his first name. David Ogilvy Freeman Mitford.
Of course, we didn't fucking remember it. And they lived in this big sort of country house. So the one son was sent away to school, but they were very, very protective and quite Victorian over the raising of their daughters, which is why they were all sort of stuck in this house for so long.
Essentially. So, got six sisters. Nancy Mitford, who everyone's heard of, who wrote Pursuit of Love and Love in a Cold Climate and other books. Very funny, famous wit. Then you have Pam, who Caroline once said in a fan casting of who should play which Mitford sister, Pam should be played by a broom. I think this is unfair.
This was during a crueler period in my life. I have now found much to enjoy in Pam, in the lack of Pam there is on the page.
She makes soup, you know?
She looks after people.
She looks after people. She takes Diana's babies. You see, we have a lot of feelings about these people.
Yeah.
In a way, it feels very weird to try and introduce people. It's like trying to introduce people to my family, being like, this is my sister. She is fantastic, but awful.
Yeah. It's very
was one time where we didn't speak, but also, I love her.
It's very that, yeah. And then next down the line, we have Diana.
Back of the letter says, the fascist who was jailed.
Which the fascist is true, who was jailed.
But she was also a great beauty.
Yeah.
She was married very young, and then she ran away for love. And, you know, if you fell in love with a mad fascist, well, no, you wouldn't, would you? But
if it was 1933 and you were extremely bored, you know... Who knows what you'd do?
I think this is the thing. Yeah, we have to be extremely careful and circumspect because neither of us want to be cancelled before Christmas.
No, you can't. But also,
we are talking about six sisters, all of whom are steeped in right-wing ideology because that was the aristocracy in the 20s and 30s.
Mm.
You know, like last week, the week before, the Tories unveiled a statue to Lady Astor who said that she hoped Hitler sorted out the Jew problem and everyone was just like, Lady Astor.
Yeah.
First Lady MP, which is a lie because of...
So it's like this, it's this consistent problem because... Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Thank you, lovely ally to the Irish people, because the first female MP was indeed Constance Markievicz. Look it up, people.
There's a great song about it, too.
There's a great song. I wrote it.
Cell of Our Own.
There is this kind of... This ongoing battle with, like, wanting to glorify the aristocracy of the, particularly the early 20th century, because it's that period of like glamour and the roaring 20s and like
flappers. Little dresses with beads on.
Yeah, and it's like, and I think as well, there is such a trend and a love of like just taking women from the past who have done anything that's subversive. And
we stan a history queen.
We stan a history queen and being like, oh, rebel girls from history. I mean, like, every other day you see Margaret Thatcher being included in some kind of, like, female role model book. And it's like, you can't just iron out women from the past as being good or bad. You know what I mean?
So we often talk about, as I think most people who graduated from the Toast and the Hairpin.
The Toast was a popular American humour site.
R.I.P.
R.I.P.
Which started off saying that their aim was to be the kind of site where you could force rank the Mifflin Sisters.
Mm.
And other things. I think most people who have read that kind of thing will eventually come to the which Mitford sister are you?
Yeah.
Internal Ms. Magazine quiz.
Yes. All women are running some kind of Ms. Magazine quiz in their heads at all times. Like last time, not last time, but one of the times you've been on the podcast, we talked about which wife of Henry VIII are you.
And I think I was going to make the same point that I'm, same point now as I made then, which is these conversations always come back to you and I saying, it's almost as if these six women, not all women, can be sorted into the archetypes of six women who happened to be in the past.
Yeah. And who really lived. Like, I think the deepest we ever got in on that was one time I was sleeping over in your house and we played which Mitford sister is which Henry VIII wife?
A classic game.
A classic game. But anyway, sorry, we are digressing.
Diana, the fascist and great beauty. Unity.
Friend of Hitler.
Friend of Hitler. We can't beat around the bush. We can't.
Deep friend of Hitler, who then shot herself in the head.
And was very disabled in ways that I personally find extremely distressing. But I think we will try and talk about it in a little bit, because yeah. I think it's interesting. And I also think it's important to not just say, the glamorous Mitford sisters, without thinking about the ways we would look at them in contemporary society. Mm. Then you get Decca, everyone's favourite, secretly the worst.
I love how we both resent Decca so much.
She's a communist, but she's also a family abandoner. And then she's kind of a bitch to to her sisters. Even when they do deserve it, they do deserve it. No one's saying they don't deserve it. Mm. But also, there's a sanctimoniousness there that I think I certainly have been capable of myself in mm-hmm. returning to my family. Like, you don't understand. I actually live in London now. And in London, we are woke.
It's very that, because Decca, or Jessica, was the... she ran away at 16. She ended up in America. She became a celebrated writer. And then she was put on the blacklist for, you know, being involved with the Communist Party.
Red list.
Oh, the red list were blacklisted. It's never good to be on a list in America. That's the thing.
What a sentence.
And so she very much gets... She gets a very loving lens placed on her, I think, because she did amazing things. Like, she wrote this amazing book about the American funeral complex that really pissed off undertakers, because she thought they were rinsing the American public.
Which they were. And the American prison system.
Yeah.
She wrote a book about that, which is... She was a really smart writer, and her husband was a very, very smart researcher. Let's talk about that later as well.
Yeah.
Do you see now why it's so hard for... me to try and explain,
because
to people.
They're so complex
and we've spent so much time talking about them, it feels like listeners to this podcast are coming in halfway through a conversation that we've been having for six yeah. years, which I think makes this a very interesting podcast, and I hope that we're not too annoying.
Yeah, well, you know what, this is the Christmas podcast, so people are going to be hiding from their families, you know, taking the dog for its 15th walk of the day. They'll be glad for any new content, so you can just put up with it, guys.
God, you know, I can't wait to listen to this on Christmas Day. No, I'm sorry. My mother listens to this podcast. She's a big fan of Caroline.
I'm a big fan of your mother.
Happy Christmas, Mum.
And then at the very end, we have Debo, who is...
Duchess.
A duchess who marries really well. Doesn't
she marries
annoy
for
anyone.
Love. She marries. She doesn't think she's going to be a duchess. She marries a younger son.
Oh, she does. That's right.
She doesn't. Billy, the older brother, is killed in the war. And then they have to be a duchess. And you know, it's hard sometimes when you just suddenly have to become a duchess. We can all relate.
Oh, especially when you're like the kind of overlooked sort of youngest baby who's everyone's like, oh, she's a bit sweet and a bit of an idiot. And then becomes like this incredibly important duchess with so many jewels. And she's just always, she never stops being like little Debo. Like, she's always just like trying to keep the peace all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, she's the only uncancellable Mitford. Oh, okay, maybe she is. Ella just made a face.
I just think it's a big claim in this, the year of our Lord 2019, to claim that anybody, particularly an aristocrat, is uncancellable.
That's absolutely fair enough.
She wrote a very, very good book called Wait For Me, which you think is going to be kind of memoir-y, gossipy, bit trashy. And it kind of is, but it has these incredibly moving chapters in about her husband's alcoholism and the loss of her children. So she had, I think, three children who died as babies, as in sort of hours old.
Mm.
And she writes unbelievingly movingly. And tactfully and carefully about that in a way that I really wasn't expecting from an aristocracy memoir.
And the thing is, like, they were all, like, with the exception of Unity and Pam, who didn't really commit themselves to that, they were all incredible writers.
Yeah.
Like, Diana was a wonderful writer. She did a lot of, like, essays and criticism.
I don't know really anything about Diana's writing, which I should say is not, I should say now is not because of a principled stand. I just haven't really come across any of her writing.
Yeah.
I felt the need to say that in case people were like, oh, well done, Ella, you've never read any of the fascist writing. It's like, no, I've read a lot of, I've read Ezra Pound, you know?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to be clear that it's not out of any.
Well done on your...
My honesty, yes.
Honesty and transparency. The podcasting world thanks you. On your willingness to read work by Nazis.
I should say, this is irrelevant, but Caroline's wearing a hat with a veil.
I am. Oh, the dog's trying to play the guitar! I thought she was being quiet, uncharacteristically.
Just licking Tasha's guitar.
This is like all... These are all like the facts of these women's lives. And I feel like that's a... by the way, well done on the introduction. I thought that was a really good potted history of the Mitford sisters. But I would like to... I think the book that people would be the most familiar with would be Nancy Mitford's The Pursuit of Love. And I think it's a novel, but it's like, you know, widely known to be... quite autobiographical and about the sort of chaotic young family life. And like, there's this lovely bit I've always really liked that I'd like to read from. So yeah, this bit is about, so it's told from the perspective of Fanny, who is a sort of a cousin and a regular visitor to this household that is clearly, you know, the Mitford household. Her tears forgotten as if they had never been, Linda rushed into the house with Labby at her heels. The Radletts were always either on a peak of happiness or drowning in black waters of despair. Their emotions were no ordinary plane. They loved or they loathed. They laughed or they cried. They lived in a world of superlatives. Their life with Uncle Matthew was a sort of perpetual Tom Tiddler's ground. They went as far as they dared, sometimes very far indeed, while sometimes, for no apparent reason, he would pounce almost before they had crossed the boundary. Had they been poor children, they would probably have been removed from their roaring, raging, whacking papa and sent to an approved home, or indeed, he himself would have been removed from them and sent to prison for refusing to educate them. Nature, however, provides her own remedies, and no doubt the Radletts have enough of Uncle Matthew in them to enable them to weather storms in where ordinary children like me would have lost their nerve completely. What do you think of that?
What do you think of that? I think that most truly successful books work because you find something of yourself in there.
Yeah.
And will move them. Will not surprise you, Caroline, my dearest friend. I see a lot of myself in this, either on the peak of happiness or trembling in the pits of despair.
Mm-hmm.
For me, my whole life is one of, this is the greatest day that anyone has ever been alive. The sun is shining and I have eaten 2 eggs. Or
like, oh, I've had a difficult phone call. I hate the earth.
Yeah. Or I've had to do a spreadsheet and therefore I think suicide is my only option. How can I go on with the great shame of having slightly made an error on my spreadsheet?
Yeah.
Even if Fanny, the narrator of The Pursuit of Love, is distant, Nancy is not distant. Nancy is in the heart of it. And the descriptions of hunting, particularly, like, not just those... So, hunting, fox hunting, but also the child hunts where they get the dogs to come after them and all the villagers are outraged.
Yeah. And it's like the most fun they have all year is when Uncle Matthew
chases them with the horses and the dogs.
Yeah.
Which does sound fun.
It sounds so fun.
Sounds like great exercise.
And it's so interesting because I've read so many, like, I'm sorry, but overly literal American bloggers who read this and, like, interpret it as child abuse. And it's like, they don't understand.
No, they run across the countryside holding a scent for the dogs, and then the dogs follow them.
Yeah, yeah. It's very much a game.
The dogs and horses try and catch them up, and they try and trick the dogs and horses.
Yeah.
And when they catch them, they go home.
Yeah.
No one is getting eaten.
No one's getting eaten.
Except foxes in fox hunting, which is a contentious subject that has no place on this podcast.
No. I read a lot of people who've, like, sort of willfully misunderstood a lot of the very obviously very strange, unorthodox parenting of the Mitford family as being, like, abusive and dramatic and da-da-da. And I'm not sure if it is, or I'm not sure any of the Mitford girls felt that way about it.
I think, A, it was a different time.
Mm-hmm.
And B, The Pursuit of Love is a novel. Ons and Rebels is a memoir, which was wildly disputed by everybody else who had that childhood.
Mm-hmm. Wait, so Ons and Rebels, what was disputed in Ons and Rebels?
So Ons and Rebels is Jessica Mitford's autobiography of her childhood. I think it takes her up to maybe her 20s.
Mm-hmm.
But the other sisters were often were kind of vocally cross about things.
Yeah. And these were sisters who, like, and bear in mind that, like, Nancy was writing books since, like, her early 20s, and they loved them. They loved the way, like, even, like, Redsdale, like, he loved Uncle Matthew, and it was even his obituary, and they used to, like, this lovely descriptions of them sort of sitting around listening to Nancy read out loud from Wigs on the Green, her first book, out of, like, an old copy book, an old essay book, and, like, them just screaming, laughing at all the people they could recognise. So these were people who could take a joke about themselves, do you know what I mean?
But I think that's the difference, isn't it, between here is a fictionalised cartoon version of our lives and Ons and Rebels, which is very much, to me, feels written with an eye on an international audience.
Yeah.
As an author, which is not a sentence I've ever said before.
And frankly, as an author.
Not one I will ever say again.
As a billionaire.
My sister has just started a new job as a copywriter in an advertising agency, and on her second week she was complaining to someone about something and said, I, a copywriter. And I feel very much like that about as an author.
I love that. I was just trying these things on and then being like, nope, that didn't come out right.
But as a writer, mm-hmm. that's fine. We're all happy with that. Yeah, that worked. As a writer who is selling my book, Midnight Chicken, is very English. I've been told this over and over over again. It is English. It is written in a very English tradition of writing. It has been very interesting to read American responses to that performed Englishness. And I do feel, particularly when I give interviews to American media, that I am performing a particular kind of Englishness.
Yes.
A particular kind of quirky, well-off, but no real money Englishness. Like,
yeah.
Which is the kind of childhood I had, right? Of having not a lot of cash, but never really wanting for anything. You know, my clothes were mostly hand-me-downs out of a big black bag from the church hall.
Yeah, there are shades of Mitford in there.
There are certainly shades of Mitford in that. I had a lot of sisters. We ran fairly wild. We were outdoors a lot. We had, you know, there was always dogs around and, you know, ponies and riding and
sure,
playing the piano and singing, all that sort of thing. But I find myself playing it up in ways that I find it myself playing it up when I talk to Americans. In the same, and I feel a certain kind of like, I see you, Decca Mitford. I see you playing what people want.
That's so interesting.
Because I do it myself. Not consciously, really. But elements of my childhood I would never think to emphasise in conversation with
other English people.
Other English people, or people, in fact, who I wasn't trying to sell anything to.
Yeah.
But when I'm trying to sell a version of myself, which you kind of have to as a writer in 2019.
Yeah, yeah. In any age, I would think, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. It probably feels particularly acute now because you're always being told, like, what's your brand? What's your this, that, and the other? Mm. I see myself emphasising very English quirk aspects of my life, which I wouldn't necessarily do. And that's how I feel when I read Ons and Rebels. Like, I see you, Decca.
That's very interesting.
I see you doing it. You're playing the game.
You can see you're hamming things up for, like, to sort of appall people a little bit. Although it's not, the whole book isn't like, let me shock you. Like, there's some incredibly, like, smart and very affectionate writing in there.
Particularly, and I don't know if we'll talk about this later, but I do want to talk about Debo and Decca talking about unity.
Yeah. Go on, talk about it now.
Oh, spotlight on me.
Who, me? Spotlight on Miss Bridger.
Because I think there is some really remarkable writing. For me, the most remarkable bits of Mitford writing are Debo and Decca talking about, particularly Decca, but also Debo to an extent, talking about their sisters who had taken political positions that they either found entirely intolerable, in the case of Decca, or at least politically politically unwise to be associated with in the
Because there was a lot of political splitting between them.
Well, yeah, so there's this... I think it comes from Debo's book, but it might be in one of the others as well. There's this anecdote about Decker the communist and Unity the Nazi sharing a bedroom and one half of the room being decorated with a sickle and with a hammer and sickle and one half being decorated with a swastika, which feels very mad now, but let's remember it was the 20s and the Nazis had not done anything
that anyone regarded as particularly
they had done some rubbish things, but not anything where you're like, you know, let's be clear what we're talking about. The Holocaust had not happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't excuse that it happened later. You know, it's so easy to tie yourself in knots when you're talking about the Nazis in the 20s, right? Because you'd hope that any human would read what they were saying and be like, absolutely not. I will never be associated with that. But
pains me to admit this that... is what why I think it's really important, because it's really hard to talk about Unity and Diana in a way that is like thoughtful, compassionate, reviews their entire characters as sisters, wives, women, people who are mentally ill, like etc. All the many things that people are, and also people who, in Diana's case, very much involved in the fascist party. In Unity's case, very much involved in the Nazi party, because I think it's hard to talk about them without sounding like you're sympathizing with these people. But also, I think it's really important, particularly in this era that we're in right now, where more and more people are converting to right-wing causes, they are becoming radicalized, they do see the appeal of these parties, to understand the shades and variations within people who become right-wing, who become ultimately like extremely right-wing. Because if you don't recognize these traits, if you don't recognise these feelings and political parties when they are budding, it means you completely miss them once they are in full flower.
Yes, and I think that's really important. I think we have all met young people, cousins or like a friend of a sibling or someone you have come into contact with on Twitter or similar, who is a young person who is like espousing right-wing views, and you're just like, you don't understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You don't understand why you're doing this. That's where Nazis come from. They come from little Nazis.
They come from teeny Nazis,
Nazis who don't understand that being like, wow, Brexit.
Yeah.
I don't know if... Does sentimental garbage have a political position?
The political position is vote Labour, and if you didn't vote Labour, then fuck you.
Well, that's why we're fucked. Oh, God. No.
We're recording this before the election.
I'm having some more Prosecco at the thought of it.
Okay, let's top us all up.
I'm sorry.
Particularly when you think of in the context of...
So long as the official position is vote Labour. Labour. Suck it up and vote Labour.
Suck it up and vote Labour.
Chin.
But I think when you review it all in the context of... Look, so the Mitfords, they were obsessed, and you can read this in every single one of their books and every recounts of their childhoods, which was extremely strange and very isolated and alienated from other society. They were obsessed with clubs. They were constantly making clubs with each other. They had the Hans, the counter Hans. They had Bootleg, which was their own like form of language that Decca and Unity created together. They had all these sort of like, they were obsessed with two things, which was clubs and meeting new people. And you can really see how fascism, Nazism and socialism, which, you know, Diana, Unity and Decca all became extremely involved in. You can see how, like, the, you know, meeting new people, having lots of very specific rules about things, having, like, you know, colours and symbols that you can, like, nail to you and stuff, like... You can see how they fell into it. It makes total sense to me.
It makes sense to me as one of a lot of sisters as well.
Yeah. Oh, you're doing this? Well, I'm doing this. You know?
It's like, my club. It's actually bigger than your club. And this is not, I would like to stress now, meant to excuse anyone from joining the Nazi party, which, let's be clear, is an extreme reaction to having a lot of sisters. I myself, never. Never so much as scratched a swastika with a diamond into a window.
But no, it is that thing of like, oh, you've got a swastika, I've got a hammer and sickle kind of thing. And like, it just kind of makes a kind of a sense with these sisters.
But, and also the sense that it's not quite real. So I've just, while we've been talking, just flicking through Ons and Rebels. And Can I just read a bit now?
Please do.
Is that all right? So, Bood, which is what... Bood?
Yeah, that is it.
Bood is what Decker and Unity call each other. They have a private language, just the two of them. The Nazi and the Communist.
Mm-hmm.
Their whole childhood, they speak to each other, and mostly only to each other, in their own private twin language.
Mm-hmm.
They call each other Bood, the same name for both of them. And I think this is... Oh, God, get a psychologist on this.
Yeah.
But Bood and I both avoided the company of the grown-ups at this time as much as we could. At Swinbrook, we lived in our bedroom except for mealtimes. We divided it down the middle, and Bood decorated her side with fascist insignia of all kinds, the Italian fasces, a bundle of sticks bound with rope, photographs of Mussolini framed in passepartout, photographs of Mosley trying to look like Mussolini, a new German swastika, a record collection of Nazi and Italian youth songs. My side was fixed up with my communist library, a small bust of Lenin purchased for a shilling in a second-hand shop, a file of daily workers. Sometimes we would barricade with chairs and staged pitch battles, throwing books and records until Nanny came to tell us to stop the noise. Yet Bood and I often teamed up together against the grown-ups in our own very peculiar version of the United Front. Once we were left in charge of my mother's produce stall at the Conservative Fete. Look at all this money, I said to Bood. It does seem a shame to think of the beastly old Conservatives getting it all. I think I'll send about £5 of it to the Daily Worker for their fund drive. Bood insisted that she was going to take, shilling for shilling, an equal amount for the British Union of Fascists. There wasn't time for an argument about it, as my mother was expected back any minute. Quickly we pocketed £5 apiece, which we dispatched that night to the respective offices. I've often wondered since what the Daily Worker people must have thought when they read the note accompanying the contribution, £5 donation from the annual Conservative Fete of Oxfordshire. And I think for me that is the most telling passage about the extreme political views of these sisters. Two daughters of a peer throwing things at each other from either side of their bedrooms.
Yeah.
Being like, oh, well, we'll take the money off mummy and we'll give £5 to the...
Yeah.
Fascists and £5 to the socialist worker. And obviously as a person with quite left-wing views, I'm like, well, it's good to take money off the Conservatives and give it to the Daily Worker. But, you know, Lenin did some bad stuff.
Well, that's the thing. So it's very interesting. So even I watched a documentary on Decker semi-recently, and her son was interviewed. And what he said was very interesting. He was like, you know, people love my mother and hate her sisters, specifically Diana and Unity. So he's like, but my mother was as fanatical about communism, about Lenin, as her sisters were about Nazism, fascism. It's like, and people forget the purges, people forget the millions of people who died under the communist regime. And it's still, because I think people still...
Sorry.
The dog's on top of Ella. I'm trying to talk about communism.
You could have jumped on me at any point when I was being frivolous.
Sylve, you're being a narc.
Communism, Sylve. It wasn't all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I think because people have become very, like, for good reasons, very taken with socialism and communism again.
It's a
great idea in theory. But, like, they forget that, like, millions of people in Russia died, you know? Millions! But that is, you know, we could say, the thing is, what's so interesting about the Mitford sisters is that you can't talk about them without also talking about, like, sociopolitics of the entire 20th century and also how they compare to the politics of now and how fucking similar they are, you know?
Yeah, and that's incredibly frightening.
Yeah.
And I actually think they give us quite a good lens. You know, there is an argument to be made for, like, why are we talking about the Mitfords again? Why are we so obsessed with the aristocracy of the past? But actually, I think... they do give us a very good lens to look at why people turn to extreme politics. Yeah. And it's not always, as, you know, many, many editorials would have us believe, it's not always they were so poor and desperate that they had turned to Trump because there was nothing else.
Yeah. Of course that exists.
Of course that's part of it.
Yeah.
But there are also a lot of people for whom it's kind of more complicated, or, as in this case, two very rich, privileged women being like, well, if you want to be a socialist, I'm going to join the Nazis and we're going to throw things at each other from either side of the room.
And what's important to point out, people who don't know the family as well as you and I do.
Darling, my God.
Darling. It's not that they joined these parties, they were highly influential members of these parties. Like, yeah. So Diana, she left her husband, Brian Guinness, of the Guinness drink.
Brian Guinness.
Heard of it?
Mr. Guinness.
Mr. Guinness himself. Yeah, she married him when she was 18, became like one of the wealthiest young brides in the fucking country, kind of lost her head for a while, just like buying things and going to parties.
Had two babies.
But like from all kind of writing about people observing her during that time, became quite like distant and sort of like, I think she was a bit like, oh, there's nothing left to want. And then she meets Oswald Mosley, who was the leader of the fascist party in Britain, and falls completely in love with him, leaves her husband, takes her children, and just throws it all in for a man who still has a wife, and they don't end up married until the wife dies.
Yeah, he doesn't leave his wife.
No. She's just like, it's a very... And like, it's not a good look to compare yourself to a known fascist on your own podcast, but like... But
please, go ahead.
I've literally done that. I literally, like, had a wonderful relationship that I thought was very happy and then met the love of my life and jacked it all in without telling him about it and then showed up and said, I've jacked it all in without telling you about it.
Very much the energy of Jonathan Safran Foer leaving his wife for Natalie Portman and not explaining it to Natalie Portman first.
I am Jonathan Safran Foer, except it worked out. Because Gavin's still around.
Before we air this, can you just check it was indeed Jonathan Safran Foer?
It was. Don't worry, it was.
Great. Oh, because he wrote the book about being vegan and she was like, I enjoyed your book. And he was like, yes, I'll leave my wife, Natalie P. That was lovely. The rumour. I do not know any of these people personally. Please don't sue the podcast.
I've got no money. Yeah, and like, what's... To stick on Diana for a bit, especially like, it's really interesting because the... As with all big families, and you know, I'm the youngest of four, you're the oldest of four, there's always a big half and a little half.
Sylv's an only one.
Sylv's an only child. In all big families there's always a big half and a little half.
Big two, little two.
Big two, little two.
What do you call them in your house? Did you have a name? Like,
I think my mom kind of refers to me and Rob. I am 30 in May, he is 31 as the babies.
We call my sisters the babies. Yeah. My sisters are like nearly 20 and 21.
Yeah. So what's fascinating is that, like, so Diana's part of the big three, and Unity, Deka, and Debo are the little three. And,
interestingly, so were the Romanov sisters, big pair and the little pair.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sisters, they're always so interesting.
Can we start a new podcast where we just talk about how...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
It is to have a sister.
We'd have 5 episodes and we'd get bored.
They'd be fucking great 5 episodes.
They would become
very good.
If
you'll pay us to do that,
no,
write into the podcast.
No, stop asking my listeners for things.
I ask them for nothing.
For nothing.
I ask for nothing. I want for nothing.
So to stick on Diana for a little while, one of the things I really like about the Midwives, because it's so true to what big families are like, in that there's always the big half and the little half. You know, I'm the youngest of four. Me and my brother Rob are always called the babies by my mum, and then like there's my...
I am the oldest of four.
Yeah.
Me and my next sister are the big two, and I was about to forget, and the little two. And the little two. The little two are both at university, one of them worked in the city for a while. They're both independent adults with their own lives.
But that dynamic never changes.
But they're the babies.
Yeah. And you see it throughout, like, even the letter collection, letters between six sisters. Throughout their whole lives, that dynamic remains. It's so interesting. But, like, what's really cool is that... So you have Nancy and Diana, and to a lesser extent, Pam. They kind of cut a machete through the long grass of, like, their father and his discipline and, like, you know... Nancy brings home all these like aesthetes and artists, and Diana goes and gets married, and the little ones, they kind of watch all this, and then it kind of primes the runway for them, you know? And so then you get like Deckup in particular, looking at Diana, and Diana just seems like this dream of an older sister. Like, she is the most famous beauty of her generation. She marries like Brian Guinness and makes her one of the wealthiest women in the country. And then she's like, oh, she's so young and she loves her family so much that she just like sends them jewelry and like silk pillowcases and all these like beautiful things. And you just get all these like letters from the younger sisters to Diana just being like, oh my God, you're the best sister ever. Like, thank you, thank you, thank you. And you just like, you can really see it. You know, I could, like, my sister's 10 years older than me, and like, I could imagine myself at that age, like, being so taken in by that. And, like, then seeing that gradual thing of, like, then Diana runs off from Brian and she becomes the pariah and nobody speaks to her for a long time. And it's just really interesting to see these women through the eyes of their little sisters, you know?
Yeah. Sorry, I was just looking at the Mifflin letters and just feeling... moved and fond of my sisters, and...
Do you want to read one of them?
The thing about the letters is the number of nicknames, and I think we should talk about that, because...
Yeah.
It's really interesting. It's really interesting to look at your own family and the ways you address each other. And I think now the equivalent would be, how do you save your siblings in your phone? Like, how do you text your siblings?
What's your WhatsApp group called, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like all these... It makes me feel slightly odd about reading these letters, even though I know they've been prepared for publication by the family.
Mm.
When I think about the emotional impact of these nicknames for these people who, in some cases, were fairly influential in the world. Unity, influence on Hitler. Diana, influence on Mosley. Decker, friend of Maya Angelou, and big in the communists.
Mm.
Debo.
Did the cover of Bang Bang Maxwell Silver Hammer.
Which we should play to close this episode out. If that's, we have the time. Why have I folded down this one? But hang on, to go back to nicknames.
Mm.
What it does give you is the sense when you're reading it of intimacy, and you lose sight of the fact that these were kind of influential people.
Yeah.
Like, so they always call Mosley Tom or Kit.
Mm. Why again?
Tom was what he was known as.
Yeah.
To his friends, which...
Weird.
I guess it's like Boris, isn't it?
Yeah.
Being called Alexander. Is that his name?
God. Depending on the election, our current or former Prime Minister, Boris Johnson.
The thing is, I was about to say, I wish we could stop talking about the election. But actually, it's incredibly pressing. It's incredibly hard. You cannot talk about the Mifflins without talking about the political climate of the time. And...
How similar it is to the one that we have now.
And that's not very Christmas. The thing is, I feel like also the other thing that makes it Christmas is like at Christmas. Christmas is the time for having a political argument with someone you love. Christmas is the time for someone you love to say for no reason something completely untenable about politics. I was going to get specific and I decided against it for reasons of wisdom. Mm. The Mifflins are... The reason they're Christmassy is because it's being with your family in a small space and some of them having political opinions where you're like, how can you think that? And you
so
think
true.
In your heart, are you just doing it to wind me up? Are you saying this because I am in London? I live in London. Are you expressing this terrible view because you think it will make me cross? And in some senses, that will be fun for you.
Oh my God,
and then we will get through the next 2 hours of Christmas. Because that thing of, well, if you're going to put a hammer and sickle, I'm going to put a swastika.
But it goes on for their entire lives.
That's Christmas.
And they never stop. Well, they do go through like periods of not speaking to one another, but it's never like permanent. Do you know what I mean?
It's only permanent with unity.
And yeah.
That's brain injuries for you.
That's brain injuries for you. But, like, there's, like, I think, is it true that, like, Nancy informed the government on her own sister, on Diana?
Yeah.
And, like...
Which I can't imagine doing. I don't know what my sisters would have to do. Yeah. If I believed they were a danger to the country, would I go to the government? I'm going to admit it here and now. Probably not.
You get the sense, though, that because, like... And there's this great bit in Ons and Rebels where, like, Decca is talking about all her favourite siblings and she's like, Nancy was fun, but she was so... She could turn on you in an instant, which meant that she couldn't be your favourite sister. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's taken to its natural nth degree is her informing the government on you, probably just to amuse herself.
And I think... If in some sense, in some senses, the Mitfords are a caricature of all families.
Yeah.
And that's what makes them so compulsively readable, apart from, obviously, they're glamorous and famous.
Yeah.
The Kardashians of the past.
The Kardashians of the past, yeah.
A lot of complex things. Do they behave correctly? No. Do you want to read about them? Yes.
Absolutely. Do you want to look endlessly at photographs of them? Of course you do.
Anyone who says they're not... I mean, look, there are probably people who aren't interested in reading about large families of sisters having complicated relationships, but I am not one of them. I can't imagine what it must be like in your heads. Simple, imagine. I guess. Zen. Full of folded underwear. Just ironed. So clean and pure. Grey and white.
It's funny, you were talking about the nicknames in the book, and like this has to be one of the few books that begins... Lots of books begin with an index of characters, and very few... begin with an index of nicknames.
Ooh, let's do a quiz. Ask me a nickname.
Oh my god. Okay, I'm going to ask you... okay, I'll start with an easy one.
It would suck if I get it wrong. If I get it wrong, just edit it out.
Okay. the woman woo our wombs.
Pam.
That is Pam. Why? And extra points if you can say why.
Because she is the woman. She is very womanly. She has nothing, no trouble. She just likes to cook and have... a house and horses, and have a husband who was so horrible to her that when she got pregnant, this is extremely distressing, trigger warning, he was just make her go driving very fast or have hot baths, and she was sad all the time, and her husband was horrible. Yeah. And I hate him. I have such a deep resentment to Pam's husband, because I think actually it is Pam's dedication to her husband that means that we don't remember Pam as being interesting.
Yeah.
Because she was just like, yeah, I'm not getting divorced from this horrible man, whereas all the rest of them were just like, and there's that. And then I burned it to the ground.
Oh yeah, they leave a myself. Husband as soon as look at you. Yeah.
Then I left my extremely rich and expensive husband and went to live with an older fascist. Then I ran away and married my cousin.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much fight or flight. All the rest of the Mitfords. Whereas
Pam is, I go and I stay.
Yeah, I do the right thing. I am stability. Yeah.
Pam is not a broom.
Pam is not a broom. I feel bad about how I've treated Pam in the past, but I now understand that we need that. It's like when we were talking about the movie Knives Out earlier on, and the central performance, the character, I can't remember the actress's name, but the character's name is Marta, and she gives a very grounded, very emotional, quite serious performance in what is otherwise a very campy film full of outsized characters who are doing mad things. And it's like, but the movie makes sense because of Marta. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, fully. And that's the same. The Mitford makes sense because of Pam.
Yeah. Next one, Bobo.
Unity.
I don't even know why she's called Bobo.
It's Bootledidge. Short for boot, I think.
Okay. Okay, this is a difficult one. Fat friend.
Prince.
Oh.
No, I thought it was Prince Charles.
You're in the right ballpark.
Who is it?
It is John F. Kennedy, otherwise known as Fat Friend.
It is devastating to me how many very influential people are just like... Well, it's like the Queen Mother is Cake, I want to say.
Is she?
Yeah.
Yeah, she is. The Queen Mother is called Cake. That is absolutely mad.
And it's not like these are code names. These are just nicknames they have for them among themselves to make their letters more funny.
Ugh. They just love their bloody letters. And what's the... we should probably think of wrapping this up, but I've just so much to say.
Well, let's keep talking and you can always get it out.
But, I do want to read... I know that you said that you did make an excellent point when you said that the reason the Midfords are Christmas is because there's nothing more Christmas than having vastly different political ideologies to your family, but loving them anyway, you know? But there
the thing
is,
even if you have quite... So my family and I are all tend to be quite left-wing, but we can still make a good family argument about the direction of the Labour Party, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, so, like, I...
Family is intrinsic on having a thing that's just like, how could you think that?
How could you...
I am correct because of the way I live now.
I honestly think the sociological function of family gatherings is so that people can say their worst thought in a safe environment, so and also have the added bonus of pissing off the people they love to piss off most. So, like, my dad will say something absolutely fucking mad. Like, he'll say something like, I mean, not this, but, like, should women even be allowed to drive or something? And he doesn't believe it, but there's some like dark like part of his mind that kind of enjoys dwelling on it and likes seeing his children being shocked by it. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's not an idiot. He knows exactly what he's doing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think all families do it. And obviously, I don't think I do it, but if you were to ask my sisters, I think they would be like, ugh, she's so woke on purpose. She's just always saying, oh, we really shouldn't say that. Could we think about how other people...
Oh, like, my entire family think I'm a complete virtue-signalling, pinko, London lefty. And
mad commie.
Mad, yeah, absolutely.
As we all know, you love money.
I do love money. If anyone has some, send it my way. I'm going to do a little Christmas reading.
Have yourself a merry little Midfort.
This is also from The Pursuit of Love, because I couldn't take all of my Midfort books from my house to your house, because I have only so many hands. Christmas Day was spent, as usual, at Auchinleck, between alternate bursts of sunshine and showers. I put, as children can, the disturbing news about Aunt Emily out of my mind and concentrated upon enjoyment. At about 6 o'clock, Linda and I unstuck our sleepy eyes and started on our stockings. Our real presents came later at breakfast and on the tree, but the stockings were a wonderful hors d'oeuvre and full of treasures. Presently, Jessie came in and started selling us things out of hers. Jessie only cared about money because she was saving up to run away. She carried her post office book about with her everywhere and always knew to a farthing what she had got. This was then translated by a miracle of determination, as Jessie was very bad at sums, into so many days in a bedsitting room. How are you getting on, Jessie? My fare to London in a month and 2 days and an hour and a half in a bedsitter with basin and breakfast. Where the other meals would come from was left to the imagination. Jessie studied advertisements of bedsitters in the Times every morning. The cheapest she had found so far was in Clapham. So eager was she for cash that she would transform her dream into reality, and one could be certain of picking up a few bargains about Christmas and her birthday. Jessie at this time was 8. And that's obviously a substitute for Decca, who did have a running away fund.
And sold her own appendix.
And sold her own appendix to her own sister.
Which is the most sibling transaction of all time. I used to sell things to my sisters.
I don't know if I did. I don't know if I had any siblings. It's because you're the youngest. I was a baby, nothing to sell.
Oh,
yeah.
God, we used to sell things to my sister all the time. She was great for money. Constantly being like, hey, Flossie, do you want to buy this leg of a teddy bear?
Yeah.
It's really fantastic.
Or the worst of all, like, I'll be your slave for a day and then just never do it.
I mean, I used to play a game called The Princess and Her Slaves, where I was a princess.
And they were the slaves.
It was a great
one. Can I be the princess? No.
You are slaveys.
You are only slaves. And then I just want to... Because, like, then, Decca doesn't run away. She runs away with Edward Romilly when she's 16. And then she doesn't really live in England again for many, many years. And...
She doesn't ever live in England again.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
She moves to Rotherhithe, of all places.
Oh,
a thing that is baffling.
Her old house was near my old house. There's no blue plaque there, and I wrote an email asking for one.
Did you?
I did, and no one responded, because no one gives a fuck about putting blue plaques up in Rotherhithe.
You'd think they would. It's getting quite fancy.
Only West London. West London has the more blue plaques than anywhere else in the country.
I want a blue plaque.
But anyway, yeah, when Decca runs away, and I know I've just done a reading, but I need to read something else.
Okay. I haven't done any.
Okay, no, I'll make you read this because I know what it is. So I know you're going to be really great at reading this.
I can't bear it. I can't bear.
I bet. Do you know what it is?
If it's the thing you wrote a song about, then yeah.
Yeah, it is.
To add to this, Caroline, noted podcast host and owner of podcast, Caroline Donahue, has got half of a secret album written about the Mitfords.
I do. I really do.
I wrote a song on it about Unity Mitford, which I have some complex moral feelings about, but also I'm very proud of it as a song.
All I want is to make enough money so I can vanity produce a studio album about the Mitfords, and then you can all hear it.
We thought about singing some of the songs for you,
but that would be decided too much.
It was too much, and you would think we were losing.
This is already a lot as it is. This is probably going to be about an hour and a half of Christmas podcasts.
No, you're going to edit it down so that we're snappy and sleek.
Sure.
I'm snappy. I'm snappy and only a little bit drunk.
But so the thing that is the most affecting about the letters from Six Sisters is the fact that you start the book and it's so busy and it's just like lots of children and teenagers writing to each other. And then as the book goes on, and it's 800 pages long, but very much like a dippy book, like you just go in and out and like find.
Highly recommended, edited by Charlotte Mosley.
An amazing Christmas present.
And Mosley, but you know, you can't.
Women in your life.
The Sins of the Father, etc. It's such a good book.
But one of the things about it is that they slowly die. And at the very end, you just have the last two, which is Debo and Diana, just writing to each other, and there's kind of notes, and there's like, oh yeah, I went for lunch with who this guy today or whatever. But most of it is kind of their regrets, and their sadnesses, and the things they've shared together that nobody else knows about.
I can't bear it. I cannot.
And there's one of the last letters in the book is Debo writing to Diana about the period when Decca ran away, and she was alone in the house.
It was far the worst thing that had happened to me. I was 16 and young for my age and very easily upset, and the whole drawn-out horror of it, the wondering what on earth had happened to her, and then the cutting off with a knife seemed unbelievable. There was a song of Harry Roy's, who we were all in love with, which went, somebody stole my gal, somebody stole my pal, somebody came and took her away, she didn't even say that she was leaving. Gal changed to hen, and there it was, the whole story. Often sung long after. She was in Esmond's thrall, and remained so till he died. I couldn't bear him, he had that effect. You either adored or hated. His death must have nearly killed her, oh poor hen. I don't think she ever saw Fav again, or did she once, I don't know. My goodness, how it all comes back. Decca softened and softened as the years went by. Her letters show that. Not unusual. Do you remember when the wife and Fav eventually met, and she said something about expecting someone fierce, and he said, all the savagery has gone out of me. Much love, Debo. Just for the listeners at home, we are both crying.
It's so awful and so beautiful.
Calm, my sister, never leave me.
Never leave me. No, it's just this thing of like, imagine the thing, like, sorry, just the things that Debo has gone through. Like, she's lost children, she's like, so many of her, like, she's at that age where so many people she knows have died, and like, she's still like, the most traumatic thing has happened to her is when her best friend left her, and her best friend didn't even think that she was her best friend, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's,
and then even then she'd be like, I hated her husband, but it must have been so horrible for her when he died.
I think what's so profoundly moving about the Mitfords' letters between Six Sisters, this collection, which is beautifully edited, you know, of all the letters there must have been to whittle them down to this.
You see
six lives, but essentially you see this whole world disappearing and dwindling to just being, eventually, just Diana and Debo, and then just Debo by herself, which is Wait For Me. I mean, the thing is, I think it's easiest to understand Wait For Me as an extended letter to sisters who aren't there anymore.
Oh, God. I didn't even realise that.
That's how I feel about kind of Debo's writing, is that she was a person who never thought of herself as a writer, never thought of herself as a creative person, and she thought of herself as a person who liked hunting and being very
country
rich. Country woman who liked her hens and horses and her husband and her babies and having a nice time and wearing lots of diamonds. But she actually wrote these thousands and thousands of letters a day. well, not thousands a day, but you know what I mean, but thousands of letters. And you kind of see in real time what it is to have a life and what it is to love people and to have those people be complex and to do terrible things, but also to do redemptive things and to do things where you love them, but you know it's inexcusable, and for many tragic things to happen to you, because that is life. You know, you can kind of look at the myth and think, oh my God, a lot of things happen to them, but actually things are happening to people all the time. You know, a friend dies, or someone you love dies, or doesn't go quite to plan, or you have to leave, or things, they just keep happening. They keep happening until you're the only one left, if you're the lucky one.
Yeah.
And I have talked to you, Carr, and also to our friend Tash, a lot about how specificity is the key to comedy. And how things are funny when they're very, very specific.
Mm.
Because it allows you to... When things are very specific and very peculiar to one person, it allows you to kind of draw it out to be like, and I know something like this.
Mm.
The specificity of the Mitfords allows me to kind of map on my own life.
Mm.
And I think that is why they have such an emotional resonance. And, you know, they're funny and they're tender and they're sad and they're charming. But there is something more than that. There's something like, I can't quite put my finger on what it is that is so completely captivating, except that, without wanting to sound too pretentious, in these mad, politically insane aristocrats, there is something of what it is to be human and what it is to be alive. Happy Christmas!
Happy Christmas!
I don't know.
No, but I also think that, like, you're totally right, and because... I think it's because nobody's a hero or a villain. Everybody is a 3D person with, you know, shades and shadows and whatever. And because so much material of these women exists, and so much material of them exists of them reflecting on one another, you get the sense in a way that you don't get with so many other women who have lived and died. A sense of their complete 3D-ness. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. And I think...
This is not the Night Stories Rebel Girls, do you know what I mean?
It is, yeah, and it's particularly relevant because they are women, and so often women in the past are helpmeets or rebels.
Mm.
There's not really... There are limited narratives about women who do evil things but are also interesting and complex and do them for interesting, weird reasons, you know? Let's be clear, it feels in these books like Diana becomes a fascist because she falls in love.
Mm.
And, you know, I feel like she would be very angry with me for saying that. I feel like she'd be like, no, I believed in the cause. But when you read the letters...
Yeah.
It seems like she met someone, fell in love, and was like, I go where you go.
Yeah. And which also is, grew up in this weird way of, like...
Nothing is real.
No backseas as well, you know?
No backseas. But also, nothing is real. There's a bit in Wait For Me, Debo's book, where she's talking about Harold Macmillan and holding, like, walking arm in arm with a member of the opposition... So, like, Conservatives and Labour just being like, oh, we're fighting on the court, but off the...
Yeah.
Once we're out of the chamber, we're dear, dear friends. Which I think is a huge part of the problem with our political establishment today. But... I guess what I mean is hypocrisy is built into being a person.
Mm.
And I wonder whether... It's really hard to talk about this, isn't it, given that this is going to come out after the election?
Honestly, I had no consensus when we got into this that we would end up being so political, but now it seems unavoidable.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the Christmas things. I wanted to talk about the fact that Fanny's dad sends her a small carriage and a pony as a Christmas present. And she's just like, hey, he's good at Christmas gifts. It's like, if someone sent me a carriage with a pony to pull it...
Why don't I have a pony yet?
27 Christmases. This is going to be my 28th Christmas. And never once a pony under the tree.
It's awful.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that, and I wanted to talk about, like, sisterhood and excitement and, you know, the Christmas pudding and... Oh, every time. But...
Every time.
But actually, that was mad because all of the Mitford's books are sad.
They are. Pursuit of Love ends with a horrible death.
Pursuit of Love ends with a sudden
Inexplicable death.
Inexplicable death of the character you've grown to love the most.
Yeah.
And everyone's just like, when she is just happy and in love.
Oh my God. Okay, so let's close out the podcast. Who wants to read the last...
Me.
I knew it would be you.
You've done
the last paragraph of The Pursuit of Love.
The bolter came to see me while I was still in the Oxford nursing home where my baby had been born and where Linda had died. Poor Linda, she said with feeling. Poor little thing. But Fanny, don't you think perhaps it's just as well? The lives of women like Linda and me are not so much fun when one begins to grow older. I did not want to hurt my mother's feelings by protesting that Linda was not that sort of woman. But I think she would have been happy with Fabrice, I said. He was the great love of her life, you know. Oh, darling, said my mother sadly. One always thinks that. Every time.
These are such happy books, and I just, maybe it's the wine, I just want to have the most cathartic cry.
I don't think they are happy books.
Well, they're funny, which I suppose isn't the same thing.
No, I don't think they're happy. I think there's a deep sense of... They're joyful, but they're not happy. There's lots of flashes of extreme joy.
Hmm.
But that's the Radlers.
Yeah.
The thing about joy and deep despair... But also them both existing at the same time. These moments of, like, lovely joy. But also every time. And I believe that with all of them, I believe that Unity thought that going off to Hitler would be the good thing.
Yeah, and shooting yourself in the head would be the good thing.
Every time people, all people, act because they think they're doing the right thing. And I...
Yeah, no one's rubbing their hands together. You know what I mean? And that's what's most terrifying of all, you know what I mean?
Particularly in this world where it seems like the bad people always win, or a lot of the time they win. They don't think... It's that Peep Show sketch. Hans, are we the baddies? Like, no one thinks they're the baddies. Every time you think it's going to be all right. And you know what? Sometimes it is.
Which is why I'm glad Labour won the election.
No. So don't wake up.
Okay, this
has been a very depressing podcast.
But I've loved it, actually.
I hope that it doesn't make people too sad on Christmas Day when they're escaping their own families, expressing their own fascist views. And I would like to stress now that no one in my family expresses fascist views, and I have to say it's because they all listen to the podcast, and I don't want to have a fight on Boxing Day where everyone's like, well, we listened to your podcast and you said we were fascists. You're not. I love you. Happy lovely. Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everyone. Merry Christmas, the descendants of the Mitfords, one of which, Max Mosley, is responsible for the downfall of the news of the world, which I think is great.
It can only be a good thing.
Yeah. Merry Christmas to all Sentimental Garbage listeners who have listened to quite a few conversations of ours this year and have put up with let's face it, quite a lot from the dog.
We've all put up with a lot from the dog. Oh God, I'm full of Prosecco, I might cry.
Let's go watch a Christmas movie. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Can we put a blanket on and maybe put some fairy lights?
Yes!
Love you!
Okay, love you, everybody. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, bye!
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.